All right, so this is Bible 241, and it is August 25th. It's our first lecture for this week, and we're going to finish up chemistry probably today. I had a couple of questions where you can find the lectures. They're not in Blackboard because they're huge files, and Blackboard is very expensive to put files. So I just put them on my own website. So here is my website at Cypress College. This is the homepage. And then what are you interested in? You're interested probably in 241 lectures, right? I don't think I have anything in for lab. You can check it out. But here's 241 lectures. And then over here, here's fall 2009, Tuesday, Thursday lectures. Click on that. And then these are the first two lectures so far and the companion text file. So those of you that asked me that question, right, that's the URL that you need to go to, and it's in the syllabus. So if you download the syllabus to your computer, it's a Word document, open it up. It's an executable link. As long as you hit the control button then and you hover over it, it becomes an executable link, so you don't have to copy and paste it. And then once you get there, just save it in your favorites. If you want to download this file so you don't have to have access to the internet every time you want to listen to it, don't forget, you can right-click, and then a menu will open up, and then save target as, save link as, or save something as, and then it will download it to wherever you want on your computer. And then you can do what? What can you do with it then? Listen to it with a media player of some kind, like Windows Media Player, Real Player, or burn it to a CD or download it to your MP3 player. Listen to it if you want. Okay. So we were in the middle of the chemistry chapter. So let's boot this up and get going with that. And we were talking about different kinds of chemical bonds. The first two kinds of chemical bonds we were talking about were covalent bonds and ionic bonds. And so if you're going to just have just a bullet point in your mind what a covalent bond is, what are you going to say?
Share electrons.
Right, since we're talking chemistry in here, the only thing that we're really interested in are the valence electrons, which are the electrons that make up the outermost shell. But nonetheless, you do have to know the rules of how atoms add electrons to these shells. The first shell has how many electrons in it?
Two.
And then the next shell has got eight, and then the next shell after that has got eight as well. And in order for that atom to be stable, those shells should be completely filled or completely devoid of electrons, which means then the next lower shell is completely full. All right, so that's how ions are formed. All right, so covalent bonds are the strongest. Sorry that I turned those lights off up there. Okay, but hopefully you can find whatever it is you're missing, right? So covalent bonds are the strongest. That's when two atoms share an electron. That's the strongest kind of bond. Ionic bonds are the next weakest. And a bullet point in your mind, how would you describe to somebody very briefly, maybe in one word, what kind of bond is an ionic bond? In one word. So for covalent, it's sharing. For ionic, it is transferring. I like that. I don't think they use that term in your book. Maybe they do. I wish they would, because it's really nice and simple and it explains everything. So one atom takes an electron and transfers it to another atom. So the first atom loses a negative charge and the receiving atom receives that electrical charge. So one atom becomes positive and the other becomes negative as a result. But even though it forms an ion, it is stable because of the configuration of that valence shell. Right now, it is either completely filled up or completely empty, so it's stable. Okay, we built a water molecule last time, and don't forget, we said that some atoms are what we call highly electronegative, and that is when they undergo a covalent bond, like a water molecule right here, which is what, H2O? This oxygen pulls most of the electrons away from this hydrogen, so that denudes this hydrogen nucleus. So if we walk up upon a water molecule from this direction right here, it looks like it has a little bit of a positive charge to it. If we walk up upon this water molecule from this direction, it looks like it has a little bit of a negative charge. All right, so, but overall, the water molecule is absolutely neutral, but it has regions of positivity and negativity, and therefore we call it polar. Different ends of the molecule have different electrical natures because of that. All right, so some atoms can form polar bonds with hydrogen, and that is oxygen, nitrogen, phosphorus, and even sulfur have a very strong pull for those electrons. And so compounds that have these atoms associated with it and have a hydrogen bond, they dissolve very easily in water, right? Because what can you tell me about electrical charges? If they are opposite, what do? They attract each other. And if they are like electrical charges, they repel each other. All right, so water is highly ordered, even though it's in a liquid state. Even though it's not frozen, it has a high degree of order to it. You could think of water as actually being like a liquid crystal because of the polarity of the water molecule. So on this positive end of a water molecule, what part of a water molecule will associate with it right here? Yeah, the oxygen will, right? And so that association then is what we call a hydrogen bond. So, and hydrogen bonds are the third kind of bond and the third weakest of the ones that we have been talking about. So here you see a diagram with a bunch of water molecules, and you see the ordered nature of just liquid water. And because water has these hydrogen bonds between molecules, I always like to ask this question, because of the hydrogen bonds, is water slippery? Or is water sticky? And as a matter of fact, yeah, you've maybe slipped on a puddle of water on the sidewalk or something, but don't forget the basic nature of water is that it is sticky because of these hydrogen bonds. All the millions or billions of molecules, right, stick to each other because of hydrogen bonds, and so water really is sticky, and that produces that that concept that we call surface tension. Maybe you've been out hiking in the woods someplace and you've actually seen insects walking right on the surface of water because they're not heavy enough to break all of those hydrogen bonds apart. All right, when we try to walk on water, what happens? Yeah, only in our dreams, right? We're heavy enough to break those hydrogen bonds and go kaplunk. But if we're very, very light, right, we can just walk right on the surface of water because these water molecules are sticking to each other. All right, so that's the third kind of chemical bond. So I'm going to list on the board in order of strength different bonds. We got what? Covalent, strongest. Ionic. How could you prove to me that ionic actually are pretty weak bonds? What would be an example? Because, for instance, if you take sodium chloride, which is held together when it's dry by ionic bonds, and put sodium chloride in water, what happens to it? It dissolves, and even, this is what happens. NaCl forms a crystal. When we put it in water, it not only dissolves, but it breaks apart into these two compounds, right? It dissociates. So you start with one molecule, and you end up with two molecules over here. And just by putting it in water is enough to break that ionic bond. And then as the solution dries out, what happens? These things get together and you can end up with crystals once again. Those bonds can reform. The third kind, hydrogen. Hydrogen bonds are the next weakest, and you should know that it's got to be some kind of atom bound to a hydrogen. And what can this X be right here? You should probably have that on the tip of your tongue. Phosphorus. What about water? That would be an oxygen, okay, or sulfur, all right? Let's see, so phosphorus, oxygen, sulfur, nitrogen will pull these electrons toward itself and thereby leaving this thing here with what? A little bit of a positive nature to it, okay. All right, the fourth kind, which we're not talking about right now, is what we call van der Waals forces. And we'll get to them sometime soon. Those are the absolute weakest. And if hydrogen bonds are due to polar compounds, Van der Waals forces are due to an association of nonpolar compounds. Okay, so they're very weak. They can be disturbed very, very easily. Okay, next topic. Unless somebody's got a question. Anybody have a question? So you would be able to build molecules, for instance. You should probably play around with a carbon atom, fill in its shells, and guess how many electrons a carbon atom wants to find? You know what? It wants to find actually four. So it can form four covalent bonds with something. So you might want to play around with that at home. Yeah. W-A-A-L-S. Van der Waals. Yeah, sorry, I wrote it a little fast. W-A-A-L-S. Okay, any other questions? Okay, so we saw strong bonds, we saw how ionic bonds are formed, and we know a little bit something about polarity. Now, what about acids and bases? Let's move on to acids and bases. Here is a table of some acids and some bases that are very common. But the definition of an acid is any kind of compound that releases protons into a water solution. All right, so we call it a proton donor. So what the heck is a proton? Well, I tell you what, let's draw an atom. Here is an atom with just one proton inside the nucleus, and it's got one electron in an orbital. So what kind of element is that? You should know how to use the periodic table to find this one, but maybe right now you don't even need the periodic table. That is hydrogen, right? So that's a hydrogen atom. And if we rip this electron away from a hydrogen atom, what are we left with? We're left with this hydrogen ion, right? Because what's the overall charge now? Plus one. But what is it really? What's another way of looking at this? Instead of saying hydrogen ion, here's a symbol for hydrogen ion, all right? But what is this really? It is just it's a proton. Okay, so a hydrogen ion, and a proton are what? Exactly the same thing. They're exactly the same thing. We use those terms interchangeably. That might seem really strange to some people, but you just have to use that terminology. So an acid is something that donates these protons to a solution. And these protons can dissolve in water very nicely, because what can you tell me about this hydrogen ion? It is charged, right? So it's polar. It has polarity. It will, what part of a water molecule will it want to associate with? So if we have water right here, where does it want to associate? Near the oxygen, because the oxygen has a little bit of a negative charge. It's going to form a little bit of a bond with this proton. So protons or hydrogen ions dissolve very nicely in water. Okay. A base, on the other hand, is a proton acceptor. All right, it lowers hydrogen ion levels when we put it in solution. So some of these examples that we see right here in table 2.2, we've got hydrochloric acid, a very, very strong acid. When we put HCl in water, it completely dissociates. It breaks down, and what do we get? So sort of like NaCl right here, we have HCl. See if I can find a darker marker. All right, we put that in water, we get, what is that? Hydrogen ion. What else could we call it? A proton. All right, plus a chlorine. And hydrochloric acid is a strong acid. It completely dissociates. That's the definition of a strong acid. Weaker acids don't dissolve or dissociate completely. Like carbonic acid does not dissociate completely. But all these others that I see there are strong acids. Sulfuric, nitric are strong acid. Phosphoric acid is not a strong acid. It doesn't completely dissociate. Okay. So what the heck is a base? It's something that lowers hydrogen ions when we put it in solution. And a really good example would be NaOH. When we put this in water, that's a strong base. It completely breaks apart. What do you think it might break apart into? How about sodium, which is that's a sodium ion. And you should be able to figure out why it only has one plus charge. Plus what else? OH. All right, that's a hydroxide ion, or a hydroxide anion. All right, and now what can happen with this hydroxide ion? It can combine with this proton right here. And what do we get if we have a proton and a hydroxide ion? What do we get? We just get water out of it. So, since this is a base, right, it produces hydroxide ions, or this accepts protons, this is a base. And if we put an acid and a base together, we say it neutralizes each other because it forms water. Okay. And then what are we left over? We're left over with NaCl, which is the salt. So the salt is left over when we put an acid and a base together in different kinds of formats. Okay, excuse me. Okay, so let's talk about pH. A little confusing, but maybe not too bad. pH is a calculation that we undergo. It's a mathematical calculation, and it tells us what the concentration of hydrogen ions is in solution. All right, so as the hydrogen ion concentration increases in a solution, do you think it becomes more acidic or more basic, or does it just remain the same? Does it just remain neutral as hydrogen ions increase? What do we know about acidity of that solution? It's got to be a water solution. Okay. So here is a beaker, and let's put a lot of hydrogen ions in this beaker right here. Lots and lots and lots. And then let's put another beaker right here, and let's put a couple hydrogen ions in here, like this. And then a third beaker with hardly any hydrogen ions in it. Could you tell me which one is the most acidic? So let's just say what? One. Case two, case three. Which one is the most acidic? Number one. Okay? So as the hydrogen ion concentration increases, we see many, many more of them here. And maybe I'll just put a little OH right here. It becomes acidic. So this is the most acidic solution. And in this solution right here, what can you tell me about the hydroxide and hydrogen ions? They're equal. And if they're equal, okay, it is neither acidic nor basic. All right, so we call this neutral. That's a neutral solution. And this one has very few hydrogen ions, but a lot of hydroxide ions. This is what we call a basic solution, or an alkaline solution. So I'll just say basic. Okay. All right, so don't forget, as hydrogen ions increase, it becomes more acidic. Now, let's talk about the pH scale. This is where things get just a little bit funny. The pH scale is just a number between 0 and 14. So it's really nice and simple, and this is how we calculate it. So you have to have a calculator for your test. I might ask you to calculate pH of something, all right? And your lab instructors know how to do this. They can tell you what buttons to push on your calculator to calculate it. All right, so pH is calculated by knowing the concentration of the hydrogen ions in solution. Take the inverse of it, right? So 1 over the hydrogen ion concentration, and then take the log of that number. That tells you what the pH is. Okay. So basically what this is doing is that if the number is 1 times 10 to the minus 1 molar concentration, all right, the pH is going to be just this exponent right here, but since it's the inverse, we have to take the negative of it, so that would be a pH equal to 1. Or if the pH is 1 times 10 to the minus 10, all right, what is the pH? Well, what's a bigger number? 10 to the minus 1, what is that equal to? That number right there, what is 10 to the minus 10? It's 0.1, 2, 3, 4, 5. I don't have enough time, right? All right, 1 over here. What's a bigger number? case one over here, case two. Case one is a lot more concentrated than this over here. But if we put this number into our formula, what do we get? We get a pH that's equal to 10, right? It's that exponent, but we have to change the sign of it, all right? So what does this tell us? As the hydrogen ion concentration goes up, the acidity goes up, but what about the pH number? It goes the opposite way. Okay, so acidic means that the pH number is going to be less than 7. If it's absolutely neutral, it's going to be exactly equal to 7. And if it's basic, the number is going to be greater than 7. So in this particular case, if we have 1 times 10 to the minus 7th molar concentration of hydrogen ions in solution, that is what? That's exactly pH 7 right here, or neutral. And at that pH, according to this diagram, you can tell me the concentration of hydroxide ions. It is going to be equal to what? 1 times 10 to the minus 7. Okay? So at neutral, the hydroxide has got to equal the hydrogen ion concentration. Okay. So that's a little confusing. So don't forget, as hydrogen ions increase, what happens to acidity? It increases. But the pH number does what? Goes down. Maybe I'll do it again because some people didn't really follow what I was saying. It's a little confusing because of that inverse relationship. As acidity goes up, what happens to hydrogen ions? It goes up. But what about that pH number? It goes down. Okay? So you just got to work with that a little bit. It will become second nature to you really quick. Okay, I think there's some questions in the book. So here is just a table that shows the concentration of hydrogen ions in terms of molarity, okay? And right at 1 times 10 to the minus 7th, the pH is 7. That's equal to the concentration of hydroxide ions. That's a neutral solution. So pH 7 is absolutely neutral. And if that pH number decreases, it becomes what? More acidic. As the pH number gets bigger, it becomes more basic as a result. Okay. All right. Well, does anybody know what the pH of our body is? And why is that important? Why is pH important? All right. This molecule, the hydrogen ion, is very reactive. That changes the chemistry of all chemical reactions. All right. And if you want our chemistry to be in balance and operating properly, the pH has to be a proper pH in our bodies. We have to have the proper concentration of hydrogens running around in there. And does anybody know what the pH of our body should be? 7.4. Yeah, it's about 7.35, 7.36, 0.37, about 7.4, somewhere in that range. All right. So we are what? Are we neutral? Or are we acidic? Or are we basic on our insides? A little bit basic, right? 7.4, that's greater than 7. We're a little bit basic inside our body. And if our pH was to change very quickly in a matter of maybe a minute or two, from 7.4, say, to 7.2 or 7.1, does that seem like a big change to you? That's a really small change in terms of the pH number, but you know what? It would be fatal. So we don't want to ever get close to death, so our body has to regulate pH, and of course, if it's maintained, what do we call that? If your pH is regulated and maintained to produce, that's homeostasis. So there are things to maintain homeostasis in terms of pH in your body. One of the mechanisms that is used are chemical buffers. So a chemical buffer is a compound, is a chemical that can resist a change in pH whenever you eat an acid or eat a base. It doesn't matter, right? If you should be 7.34, a buffer resists a change in pH. It doesn't mean that a buffer takes you to pH 7, because that would be fatal. It just maintains your proper pH for you, which is about 7.4. And do you ever eat acids or bases? Oh, we got some Rojo Toro right there. Okay, I don't know what the pH of that is, but I would guess that could be around pH 1 right there, Red Bull drink. Coca-Cola is about pH 1, all right, and you drink down a big Slurpee of that. If we didn't have buffers in our body, that would be fatal, that would be lethal, all right? So buffers will get rid of those excess hydrogen ions that we eat. So an important buffer is the bicarbonate buffer system in our body. And here is the equation right here. We have CO2, which is what our body produces through cellular respiration and water. These can combine to produce H2CO3. That looks like a zero on this slide right here, but that should really be an O4. O stands for oxygen. How many protons in the nucleus of an oxygen? You can look over on that periodic table. All right, that's just a little quiz for fun. All right, but now since this is in water, this can dissociate into hydrogen ion and bicarbonate. All right, and so when we put in a lot of hydrogen ions by drinking a Coca-Cola or something, this hydrogen ion that's in our diet, the food that we just ate, will combine with bicarbonate and will force the reaction in this way, and it will then eat up this hydrogen ion, therefore maintaining the proper pH. So this bicarbonate ion right here, what we say, buffers pH because it can actually sequester these hydrogen ions or protons right out of solution to maintain the proper pH in your body. All right, and for instance, if you eat a food that is very basic or alkaline and it starts to bind up a lot of these hydrogen ions in your body, and what would happen to the pH if all of a sudden you ate something that was taking hydrogen ions out of solution? What would happen to the acidity? Would it go up or down? If something you ate is taking hydrogen ions out of your body, your pH, the acidity would go down. Okay? The pH would go up, and again, that could be lethal, but because of this bicarbonate reaction right here, if these hydrogens are taken out of solution, your body can actually make some more from this CO2 reaction. So CO2 will combine with water to make carbonic acid, and then that's going to dissociate to replace these hydrogen ions that are missing from your body. So this is a very nice buffer. There are a number of other buffers in your body, namely, say, a phosphate. There's a phosphoric acid that's used as a buffer. So you got to know what a buffer is. It does what? It doesn't keep your body neutral. A best way to think of it is that it prevents any change in pH, right? It resists a change in pH. So if you're a little bit basic, it will maintain that little bit basic nature in your body. It won't force you to pH 7. All right, so here you see the normal range, 7.35 to 7.45, maintained by various buffers. If it's less than 7.35, we call that an acidosis. If it's greater than 7.45, that would be beyond the normal range of pH, that would be an alkalosis. All right, let's move on to some organic molecules. Yeah, question.
If that has to do with the changes like in a diabetic?
Absolutely. Yeah, there are different ways that acidosis or alkalosis can be produced in individuals. Some can be what we call metabolic in nature, produced by metabolism inside the cell, but we can actually produce radical pH changes in our body just by breathing as well. Because in our normal breathing, we breathe out carbon dioxide, and in that previous slide, what can carbon dioxide produce? Carbon dioxide can produce carbonic acid, which produces hydrogen ions, but if we start to hyperventilate, we lose a lot of carbon dioxide from our body, and it's going to drive these reactions to the left, using up a lot of hydrogen ion in our body. So just by hyperventilating, that can produce an alkalosis. We can lose hydrogen ion just by hyperventilating, and we wouldn't call that a metabolic alkalosis. We would call that a respiratory alkalosis. So there are different kinds of mechanisms that will produce acidosis or alkalosis. Could be due to breathing disturbances. If somebody can't ventilate their lungs properly, okay, they might become acidotic as a result of that. Like maybe from asthma, emphysema, for instance, or if they have other kinds of obstructive pulmonary diseases. But probably the more common would be a metabolic acidosis due to some kind of metabolism imbalance in somebody's body. Yeah. So we'll probably look at some of those things during the course. Yeah. Okay, organic molecules. Let's see if we have a good definition for an organic molecule. Are those that contain, this is a good definition. Sometimes it's not proper in a lot of textbooks, but it has to be a molecule that has a carbon atom in it. But one other thing, it's got to have a carbon and a hydrogen that are covalently bonded. And you could draw your little shells out and show me sometime how those electrons are interacting between a carbon and a hydrogen. But right now, just to let me know, if you're tracking with me, what can you tell me about those electrons? How are they interacting with each other between a carbon and a hydrogen in an organic molecule? They are, nice. Yeah, they're being shared, right? A covalent bond means that those valence electrons are being shared. They're not being transferred, right? They're being shared. Okay, so here we have some, but that doesn't mean that some molecules that are not organic are not important biologically. Like, for instance, what about CO2? Is that an important biological molecule? Yeah, because our body's producing it all the time, but is that an organic molecule?
No.
Somebody said no. Why don't you like that as being an organic molecule? It doesn't have a hydrogen, right? Covalently bound to that carbon right there. All right, so it's not an organic molecule, but it's one that your body produces. Your body produces inorganic compounds all the time. What about another really important molecule? What about water? Is that organic? Okay. What does an organic molecule have to have? It's got to have a carbon covalently bound to a hydrogen. Well, this one, H2O, has got hydrogen, but no carbon. This is probably the most important molecule in your body, but again, it's not organic. Okay? So just really rely on those definitions. Okay. So I want you to become familiar with four important classes of important biological molecules. All right? And it just so happens that they are organic because I see a carbon right here. And this line represents one pair of electrons that are being shared with this hydrogen atom. So these are all organic molecules because you see carbon and hydrogen. Some of these are not important biologically. All right, like hexane is not important biologically, but it is an important organic molecule. This is what it looks like when it's just a nice linear molecule, but what it likes to do, this molecule likes to bend on itself and form this nice ring structure right here. And that's a pretty stable molecule, even though it started out as just a straight chain of hydrocarbons. So a hydrocarbon, can you see a hydrocarbon right here? Hydrocarbon means what? A carbon with hydrogens on it. That's all that means, a hydrocarbon. Okay. Okay, and it can form these various kinds of ring structures right here. And substituting in certain locations on a carbon atom can be a different, what we call functional group. So, for instance, this one right here, this carbon, instead of having two hydrogens bound to it, that's what this little symbol here means. If you just have a straight line, to be accurate and complete, what should you draw in this location right here? You should actually draw a hydrogen atom, but to keep life simple and a little bit faster, we don't draw all the hydrogens in. If we leave it off, that means that there's a hydrogen there. But for instance, this carbon has a double bond to an oxygen. So that changes the structure of this molecule right here. And what can you tell me if we change the structure of something? What else changes? You know what? And we're going to explore this a lot in this class. If you change the structure of something, you're going to change its function, its functionality. So guess what we call these things? We don't call these structural groups. We actually call these functional groups because we're really changing the nature of these molecules. So this functional group right here is what we call a carbonyl group. And instead of a hydrogen, we have an OH group. We call that a hydroxyl group. And instead of a hydrogen, if we have an SH group, we call that a sulfhydryl group. And instead of a hydrogen, we have an NH2, that's an amino group. And if on the end of a molecule, instead of having three hydrogens, we have COOH, that's what we call a carboxyl group, and that's an acidic group that makes this an acid, an organic acid. All right, and then if there's a PO4, that's a phosphate group, and again, that imparts a lot of different kinds of function to these molecules. So I do want you to know what a carbonyl group is, what a carboxyl group is. So if I put this on the test right here, you would say that this is an amino group because of that nitrogen with two hydrogens on it. All right, so I won't ask you to draw these out, but I will at least ask you to be able to recognize them. Okay. All right, so here we have an organic, the carboxyl and phosphate group, these are organic acids because when we put this thing in water, this hydrogen right here likes to dissociate and go into solution. Right, and it becomes a proton floating in solution. Same thing with this hydrogen atom. It dissociates from this carboxylic acid and it donates the proton to a solution, which is the definition of an acid. So these would be organic acids. All right. Well, there are four important biological compounds and they are organic molecules, but maybe you should actually think of them as being biological molecules and not just organic. The first one is what we call a carbohydrate. What's another name for a carbohydrate? Runs around by a couple different names. Sugar is a really good another name for a carbohydrate, and it could also be called a saccharide. A saccharide, sugar, carbohydrate are all the same kind of terms. And if we look at a carbohydrate, so here we have three different carbohydrates, and if we were to look at the carbon backbone, how many carbons do you see in glucose and galactose and fructose? They're each six carbon sugars, so they have that similarity, but they're each distinct from each other because if we look at, for instance, this carbon right here, right, then we could say that's the fourth carbon from the carboxyl group. Notice that in glucose, in this molecule, the hydrogen is on the left-hand side, but for galactose, we have what? That's what we call a hydroxyl group, right? Hydroxyl group. But in fructose, notice that there's a carbonyl group right here, all right? So the nature of this molecule, even though it's a six-carbon sugar, changes. Now, I'm not going to ask you to tell me the difference between galactose and glucose, but you should just know that there are some minor differences that make up these molecules. And any straight chain hydrocarbon, right, can form a ring structure. So sugars in our body, right, usually are just drawn as these ring structures, and we like to even just leave out all of these other things that are sticking off of the ring to make it simple. So if you see something that kind of looks like a stop sign right here, that should kind of remind you that it's actually a sugar molecule. Okay. The general formula, let's just look at this carbon right here. What's the general formula, chemical formula? We have a carbon, and then what do we got? I see a carbon atom, and what other atoms do we see right in this position right here? We see how many H's? Two. And what else? And an oxygen. What do we call H2O? Oh, look at that, water. Isn't that amazing? We have carbon and water. So when people first started to look at sugars and saccharides, they noticed for every carbon there was a water molecule. And so how do we start talking about something that has a carbon and a water molecule in each position? We call that a carbon hydrate. All right, and instead of saying carbon hydrate all the time, let's just simplify it. Let's just say carbohydrate. So a carbohydrate has, in it, for every carbon, has a water molecule attached to it, okay, H2O. Okay, so these are really good examples of six-carbon, what we call monosaccharides, because these things can bind together, they can form covalent bonds, right? So if we bind the galactose with a glucose together, that's going to form not a monosaccharide, but what we call a disaccharide. All right, so a monosaccharide is just a simple sugar made up of maybe just a glucose. But if we put galactose and glucose together, that would be a disaccharide. And guess what we get if we put a glucose covalently bound to a galactose covalently bound to a fructose? What would that be? That would be a, I won't tell you, you could tell me. That would be a trisaccharide, right? And after that point in time, we kind of get bored with that terminology. So if we have thousands of glucose molecules put together, right, we would call that a polysaccharide, many saccharides joined together, right? But basically, you should know that the basic building block of a polysaccharide is a monosaccharide. And maybe give me a couple examples of monosaccharides that you know of. What are some examples of monosaccharides? Specific examples. Yeah, they're sugars. Monosaccharides are sugars, but give me some specific names of some monosaccharides. Glucose, galactose, fructose. Yeah, those would be some really good examples. Okay. All right, so disaccharide has got two monosaccharides covalently joined to each other. Sucrose, which is on our tables at home, table sugar, it's got one glucose and one fructose. All right, and plants like to make sucrose. All right, and fructose is a sugar that we find in fruit. Sucrose is a sugar we find in fruit. All right, so sucrose is a, what kind of saccharide is sucrose? Disaccharide. Lactose. Right, has one glucose and one galactose, and this is what we call milk sugar. Right, galactose is a sugar that we find in milk that's a nutrient for infants, and this takes a special enzyme to break the bond between a glucose and galactose, and as we get older and older and older, our body stops producing that enzyme, right? And so our bodies can't digest lactose as we get older. And that produces malabsorption syndrome, maybe that I'll talk about, because our bodies don't produce the enzyme that breaks lactose down. There is some terminology. If we take a word like lactose, lactose is a sugar, O-S-E on the end of it, and we can then define, by modern nomenclature anyway, the enzyme that will break this down by changing this O to an A, right? So lactase is the enzyme that breaks down lactose into glucose and galactose. And guess what our body stops making as we get older? Lactase. So if we eat lactose in our diet, like unfortunately what? Milkshakes, ice cream, all right? That will produce a malabsorption syndrome because this lactose passes through our digestive tract, our small intestine, which is important for absorption, gets into our large intestine, and who's waiting in our large intestine for any kind of food morsel? Bacteria, right? And so they go nuts, they say thank you, and produce a lot of gas, and what else? Copious amounts of watery diarrhea, right? Okay, so that's malabsorption syndrome. Okay, maltose is another, what, disaccharide, right? And it's just two glucoses put together, right? So maltose is just two glucoses put together. Polysaccharides are when we take, what, thousands, potentially thousands, maybe tens of thousands of monosaccharides and join them together. And when we have glucose all covalently bound together, if it's in a plant, plants like to make a compound called starch. So what's the basic building block of starch? It's a monosaccharide, and in particular, tell me the specific name. There's only one monosaccharide that makes up starch. And that is actually cellulose. Cellulose is a polysaccharide. Okay, it has the same building block as starch. It is actually glucose. Right? So starch and cellulose are just made of glucose. So when you eat starch in your diet, give me a good example. Like bread, okay, anything that's made of flour, potatoes, pasta, what is it like eating? A sugar cube, right? It's just pure sugar. Starch is just pure sugar, but it's just put together in a different way. Your body stores glucose, but not in the form of starch. The branching, it has different branching patterns to it. It looks a little bit different. It's more branched than starch is. And so we call it animal starch, but actually we should call it in here glycogen. All right, so glycogen is the big polymer of glucose that's stored in our bodies. And I think in the first lecture, the first chapter, there is one organ that we know that stores a lot of glucose in our body in the form of glycogen. Can anybody remember what organ that was? And I heard the right answer. It's the liver. So the liver stores glucose in our body. And so when our blood sugar, when our blood glucose starts to drop, there are signals, namely glucagon from the pancreas, that tell the liver to release that glucose into the blood to bring our blood glucose back to where it should be. That's an example of what kind of mechanism? Okay, I was thinking like homeostasis, yeah? But if you're interested in, yeah, positive or negative feedback, yeah, there's negative feedback involved with that. Okay. All right, so how can we make complex sugars from simple sugars? So here we have a glucose and a glucose. These are examples of what kind of sugar? A monosaccharide, right? So here are two monosaccharides. And look what we got. Look at these functional groups we have right here. This is a hydroxyl group. Here's another hydroxyl group. And when these two molecules bump into each other in just the right way, right, these two ends bump into each other, this hydroxyl group can combine with this proton, and guess what it produces? Water. And then it forms a nice covalent bond. So here is a disaccharide made of two glucose molecules. We call that maltose. It produces water. All right, so this is what we call a dehydration synthesis reaction. We're synthesizing this maltose from this glucose. We also call it a condensation reaction because what comes out of it? Water. Now, this is sort of interesting from another viewpoint. What's the solvent that our body is dissolved in? We're just basically bags of fluid, and what's the fluid? It's water. And not only is water the solvent that we're dissolved in, but water also participates in many, many chemical reactions in our body. That's something very unique to water chemistry. Okay, so not only is it the solvent, it's just not a passive solvent, it's actually produced or consumed by many chemical reactions in our body. All right, so here we have a couple other, what are these? What's glucose and fructose? These are monosaccharides. They can be joined together by what kind of chemical reaction? A dehydration synthesis or a condensation reaction by taking this proton and this hydroxyl group, producing water, and then you're left with sucrose right here. Okay? All right. So hopefully you'll see that this is a nice reaction that your body uses time and time again. Okay. Polysaccharides can undergo the reverse reaction. All right? So I didn't have a figure in your book, but draw this arrow back the other way. We can take a maltose with the correct enzyme and a water molecule, split this water molecule up, and put a proton and a hydroxyl group on either of these glucose molecules to what? Break that maltose down. All right? Now, this reverse reaction is what we call a hydrolysis reaction. Because why? Hydrolysis, because we're using water to split this polymer apart. The same thing can happen for sucrose. We can break sucrose down into fructose and glucose by what kind of reaction? A hydrolysis reaction. Okay. And what do you need for a hydrolysis reaction? You need water. Yeah. Well, you need some kind of polymer, but basically you need a water molecule. I'll ask that question again a couple more times. All right, another kind of biological molecule, instead of a polysaccharide or saccharide or sugar or carbohydrate, would be a lipid. Lipid is another class of compounds in our body. These are, you probably should have a feel for this, these are insoluble in water, right? If you ever get, for instance, oil on your clothing, or maybe you made some toast in the morning and put butter on it and it fell out of your hand, how does it always fall? Butter side down, right on your pants, right? And you get that butter on your pants. Can you just take a wet paper towel and get that butter out of your pants? No, because oils and water will never mix. Because water is what kind of compound? It is polar. And lipids are nonpolar compounds. They're nonpolar compounds. And since they're nonpolar, they are called hydrophobic. They're afraid of water. Don't want to mix with water one way or the other. Because they're made out of hydrocarbon chains. They don't typically contain oxygen. They don't contain nitrogen or phosphorus on them. They're just long hydrocarbon chains, and so they don't produce polar bonds. All right, so let's talk about some kinds of lipids. We have triglycerides in our body, which are important. Probably some of you have had a blood test and you actually had triglycerides measured in your blood. What the heck is a triglyceride? Okay. How are we doing on time? Well, we got a little time left. Okay. A triglyceride is made up of, you should know the building blocks of this, three fatty acids. All right, so remember, carboxyl group is an acidic group, and here's a really long hydrocarbon chain. This is the hydrophobic part of the fatty acid, and fatty acids dissolve in water a little bit because of this carboxylic end. Right? And this hydrocarbon chain could be 20 carbon units long, or 8, or 15, various kinds of amino acids in your body. And here is the second building block necessary to make a triglyceride. This is what we call glycerol. And glycerol is sort of like a sugar molecule, but how many carbons do you see? It's got three. All right? And this OH group can combine with this proton from the carboxyl group on a fatty acid, and that can form a covalent bond right here. And that can happen three times. So how many water molecules are produced? Three water molecules are produced. Now you have the three fatty acids bound to glycerol, and that becomes a molecule. This is what we call a triglyceride. All right, so what kind of chemical reaction does your body use to make a triglyceride from three fatty acids and glycerol? Dehydration synthesis reaction. Right, so this right here is a nice ester bond. That's a dehydration. And if your body wants to break down this triglyceride, what kind of reaction would it use to break a triglyceride down into three fatty acids and glycerol? It would be, yeah, a hydrolysis reaction. So your body doesn't have to invent new chemistry over and over and over again for different classes of chemical compounds. It can use what that same nice process over and over and over again. Okay. So here are some examples of some fatty acids. We know this is a fatty acid because this is a fat, just a long hydrocarbon. There's nothing polar in this molecule right here. And then what do we got on the end right here? Can anybody remember what this thing is? The COOH group. That is a carboxyl group or carboxylic acid group. And because of this functional group right here, what does it allow this fatty acid to do? To undergo the dehydration synthesis reaction. If there was no carboxyl group, then it couldn't undergo the dehydration synthesis reaction. Your body couldn't produce triglycerides out of it, right? So that's why we call this carboxylic acid a functional group. When we change the structure of this molecule, we would change the function of this molecule. Palmitic acid is what we call a saturated fatty acid because on every carbon, we see that it has a maximum number of hydrogens on it, which is how many? Two, right? There are two hydrogens for every carbon. It's completely saturated with hydrogen atoms. But linolenic acid, on the other hand, we see some carbon atoms have a double bond, so that means that it can't bind two hydrogens in this location. We call this an unsaturated fatty acid. An unsaturated fatty acid. Okay. Another kind of lipid. We can start with this three-carbon molecule right here. Can you remember what this three-carbon molecule is that has these three OH groups on it? That is glycerol. And on the first two positions, we can bind a fatty acid here and here. But on the third position, instead of substituting a fatty acid, we can put a phosphate group with another functional group. This is a phosphatidyl group. I don't think you have to know the name of it necessarily. But it ends up becoming, this part right here is the lipid part, and this part right here is what we call the phosphate part. So this becomes a molecule that's really cool because it's a phospholipid. It has a couple of different natures associated with it. What's the nature of these fatty acids right here? Is it polar or nonpolar? Nonpolar. Does this region of the molecule like to dissolve in water? No, because it's polar. Now, what about this phosphatidyl group that has the phosphorus and this nitrogen? What do you see right here? A minus sign. So what does this mean? Is this phosphate group polar or nonpolar? It becomes polar. So this part of this end of the molecule can actually dissolve in water because it this molecule has two different natures. So you see the shaded region right here is the part of the molecule that is hydrophilic, but these long hydrocarbon tails over here is part of the molecule that is hydrophobic. It doesn't want to have anything to do with water. So this produces a magic molecule that has these two natures to it, and we call it what? A phospholipid. Okay, so here is the hydrophilic part, and here is the hydrophobic part down over here. So it likes to dissolve in both kinds of compounds. All right, we start at 11:30. Okay, we got a little ways longer. So let's go to another diagram pretty quickly right here. And what's that? That is a salad dressing bottle. Okay? And what can you tell me about this salad dressing bottle when you just take it out of the refrigerator? How many parts are in there? It's got two parts. All right, so here's this middle part. Here's the top right up over here. What's down? What kind of part is down here on the bottom? Okay. And what kind of part is up over here? Maybe you really haven't investigated your salad dressing bottle, but let's dissect it. What is down over here? Is this the oil or the water? Water is the heavy stuff, right? So here is the H2O part. And what's down in here? Oh, you got like spices, right, and salt and stuff like that. And then what's on the top part? Oil. Okay. And this line right between them we call a meniscus, right? And before we use this, what would you like to do? Would you just like to pour it on your salad? Because what would happen if you did? You would just get the oil on your salad. Not so good because you'd be missing out on all these goodies down here. So what do? You shake it up, right? Okay, and then you're done with it. You put it back in the refrigerator, and what happens? It goes just like that again. And all by itself, or did you have to do something special to it? No, all just by itself, right? Because this is the hydrophobic region. This is the hydrophilic region. All the polar molecules end up over here. All the nonpolar end up over here. Just by, it happens automatically, by the nature of those molecules. All right, now let's talk about that phospholipid. Here's that phospholipid, right? Phospholipid, and you should kind of understand how it's the structure of this phospholipid, right? Like there's a phosphate group right here, which has a charge on it. So this region right here is what in terms of water? Hydrophilic, loves water. And this region right here is hydrophobic, hates water, afraid of water. So let's take this molecule, throw it in the salad dressing bottle. Where is it going to go? Is it going to go up in the oil? Is it going to go down in the water? Who votes for down in the water? Nobody. Oh, so that means it's up in the oil. No, neither. Ah, where's the last place? Right on the meniscus, right? So we've got the phosphate, what we call the head group, down in the water, and what's sticking up into the oil? The hydrophobic region. Did you have to do anything special to get that molecule exactly at this location right here? Anything special? It just happens automatically, you know, almost like by magic. Now, let's put in, instead of one molecule, let's put in thousands of molecules. What's going to happen? They're all going to line up just like this, all right, with the hydrophobic tail sticking up into the oil, because that's where these guys are happy at. And now, look what we've made, just automatically. We didn't have to do anything special. This now is beginning to look, has a lot more structure than just the meniscus. This thing right here now is actually starting to look like a membrane. What did we have to do to build this membrane? Nothing special, just put the pieces in there, right? And so membranes have the ability to self-assemble themselves, right? And that's the basic component of a cell structure, is a membrane, right? And A cell is the basic unit of life, the basic building block of life. So life really has a tendency to do what? Just basically build itself out of the nature of being either hydrophilic or hydrophobic. All right, so that should be pretty amazing. So let's get rid of this salad bottle and just put a beaker, or put a bottle right here, a beaker or a bottle or something. And we only have water in here, only H2O, and we put a bunch of phospholipids. Guess what's going to happen to those phospholipids? The lipid part of it won't have any place to go because there's only water, except what? Each other. The tails will associate with each other, and the phosphate groups will associate with the water, and it will form this kind of structure. Right? Because these guys over on the inner part of this circle hate water. The head groups love water. And we see the water molecules then associating with the phosphate groups because they're all polar. And now what have we formed? Not just a membrane, but something that actually looks like a cell. Right? And we call this thing a micelle. So a phospholipid is something that can just automatically form micelles with a little lipid part to it. All right. Which is one of the basic building blocks of how you make a cell. Another kind of lipid that we're interested in are what we call steroids. So here is a molecule of cholesterol, and these are just long hydrocarbon chains that have formed cyclic rings. And if you were to look at this molecule, maybe you could see it kind of resembles like a staircase or something. Like here's a step and then another step and another step. All right. So I do want you to recognize this general structure as being a steroid of some kind. I don't want you to know that this is testosterone and this is cortisol and this is estradiol down here. But if I show you a molecule that looks like this or like that or like that or like that, you should be able to say that's what, a sugar? No, it's a lipid, and in particular, what kind of lipid? Triglyceride? No, it's a steroid. Okay. And what this diagram also shows is that, well, I guess maybe I'll ask you a question first. Cholesterol, is that good to have in your body or bad? I hear good and bad. Okay. Too much of it plugs up, right? Plugs up your blood vessels, causes arteriosclerosis, atherosclerosis, cardiovascular disease, but you need the proper amount because cholesterol is a precursor molecule to cortisone. It's a precursor to testosterone, precursor to other sex hormones like progesterone and estrogen. So you need that molecule in your body to regulate reproductive potential. Okay, so you have to have some. Here's another kind of lipid. Notice that this is a long hydrocarbon chain with a couple substitutions on it, and it's been bent in the middle right here, but here's the carboxyl group, and these are what we call prostaglandins. Here's a sign-in sheet. Sorry, it's a little late, so sign it really fast and pass it on. All right, prostaglandins are signaling molecules. They control various kinds of processes in your body. And basically, they come from fatty acids, but they're lipids. Prostaglandins are lipids. Okay, so let's review. What are the two general classes of organic compounds we've studied so far? Carbohydrates and lipids. What's the basic building block of a carbohydrate? A monosaccharide. Could you give me a name of one specific one? Yeah, glucose, good example. If we put two glucoses together, what kind of reaction do we use? Dehydration synthesis. If we break apart a disaccharide into two monosaccharides, what reaction do we use? Hydrolysis reaction. Good. All right. What's the next kind of compound, general class that we looked at? Lipids. Yeah. What are some lipids? Give me some examples. Triglycerides, steroids, phospholipid, magical lipid, and prostaglandins. Okay. So if we take three fatty acids and a glycerol, how can we make a triglyceride? What reaction do we need? dehydration synthesis reaction. If you want to break a triglyceride down, maybe you need a fatty acid for energy. What reaction do you use? Hydrolysis reaction. Okay? So we're using that same kind of theme over and over and over again. Protein. All right, proteins are made out of a building block, and you've known this probably before you took this class. What's the basic building block of a protein? Amino acid. All right, how does your body put amino acids together to make a protein? What kind of reaction? I haven't shown you, but take a guess. Dehydration synthesis reaction. When you break a protein down into its building blocks, namely amino acids, guess what reaction is used? Hydrolysis reaction. Yeah. Okay, so probably I don't even have to show you these slides. Oh, but I will. All right, so here is an amino acid. And so here is a central carbon. And on this carbon, on one side, there is what kind of functional group? Our carboxyl group. And what does that mean? What, when we put this carboxyl group in water, what happens to it? This proton, it releases protons into water, so it's really what kind of compound? It's an acid, right? So here is an acidic group because of the carboxyl group. What is an NH2 called? The functional group is called an amino group, right, on this carbon. So if we have an amino group and an acid group, we call that an amino acid. Okay, so here is just a general formula for an amino acid. This R means that there can be different kinds of substitutions on this position of a carbon atom. And, for instance, here is an amino acid that has this CH bounded to two other methyl groups right here. This is valine. Here is tyrosine, right? There is this long hydrocarbon ring right here. And these are all nonpolar groups because I don't see any oxygens or phosphoruses or nitrogens bound to a hydrogen right here. So this part of the molecule doesn't like to associate with water, but this part over here and this part over here does. Okay. So there are 20 different kinds of amino acids. I'm not going to ask you to be able to recognize them by their chemical structure or really much about their chemistry based on these functional groups. But you should at least know that different amino acids differ from each other by what is substituted right here on this central carbon. Okay. And some can be basic, some can be acidic, some can be nonpolar, depending on what group is put right here. Okay. All right, so how do we put amino acids together to make a protein? We said dehydration synthesis reaction. Well, here is just what, a general formula for an amino acid. Here's another one. Here's another one. We see four amino acids. Here's an OH group. Here's a protein, proton on this amino group. These can be pulled off to form water. And we're left with this nice strong covalent bond. So proteins that are put together by dehydration synthesis are put together by very strong covalent bonds. And we call this a peptide bond. These are a little bit stronger than the average kind of covalent bond. So it's actually difficult to break down peptide bonds or proteins because of that. So this right here has how many amino acids in it? It's got 1, 2, 3, 4. Right? So if it had 3, we would call that a tripeptide. If it had only 2, it'd be a dipeptide. I don't know what we call it if it's got 4. Okay, we would call it just a peptide because it's made up of different amino acids. Okay, so it's always made by dehydration. But if we put over 100 amino acids together, it's no longer called a peptide, it's called a protein. It's something that's really gargantuan, it's really big on a molecular scale. And if it's less than 100 amino acids, right, if it's greater than 3, that would just be called a peptide or a polypeptide. Okay, and these proteins can form different kinds of structures depending on how amino acids are used to spell out how to make a protein. It changes the structure. The primary structure of a protein is determined by its amino acid sequence. All right, so here is the first amino acid, here is the second, here is the third, and these could be different amino acids. Like this could be a valine, this could be a tyrosine, right? And this one over here could be a glycine. So that means that if we change the structure of this protein, that's going to also change its function as well, right? So the primary structure is just how your body puts different amino acids together in what sequence to make a protein. And a good way of thinking of that is when you have a word, right, a word will have certain letters that make it up. But in order to understand what that word is, what do you have to do with the letters? Can you put them together in all different kinds of ways, or is there only one specific way that you can use those letters to make a particular word? Like somebody's name, Linda. You got an L, an I, an N, and a D-A. Can you put them together in any fashion you want?
No.
The L's got to come first, right? And the I's got to be second, right? So that would be like the primary structure of a protein. You've got to put the right amino acids from beginning to end in the right order in order for it to work properly. And we would call that the primary structure. Okay. And if we spell the protein properly with the right order of amino acids, right, just like if you were to take a thread that you use for sewing and stick it in your pocket, what's going to happen to it? Is it going to stay nice and long and thin? It's going to curl up, right? And if the primary structure is proper in a polypeptide or a protein, it's going to fold and twist and turn on each other just the right way, right? So the primary sequence has to be proper. It's going to form something that looks like this coil right here. This is a special kind of structure that we call the alpha helix. But in order to have the alpha helix, what does this polypeptide have to have? It's got to have the proper primary structure. And guess what? If we change the primary structure, guess what's going to happen? This secondary structure is going to change as well. Maybe it won't form this alpha helix. So there are two kinds of secondary structures that proteins like to make. This coil right here, this is a lousy diagram of it. That's better on the screen right there. This is the alpha helix. Right? Another kind of structure looks like this, zigzagged pattern. And take a guess what this is. This is the second term on your slide. That's the beta pleated sheet. And what determines whether a sequence of amino acids is going to make an alpha helix or a beta pleated sheet or maybe just kind of nonsense? What's going to determine this secondary structure right here? It's going to be the primary structure. So think of primary structure as being the building block for secondary structure. Okay. And guess what? We have more structures to be interested in. So here we have a long polypeptide chain made up of thousands of amino acids, and we can see a segment of it has a nice alpha helix. Alpha helix is what we call what kind of structure? Secondary structure. And maybe we can see some other segments that have a beta pleated sheet, or they're just coiling around randomly. Okay, so these are not, this would not be an alpha helix or a beta pleated sheet right here. But because of the order of amino acids, this protein has a particular shape. Based on the alpha helix and maybe some beta pleated sheets, it will curve back on itself and form, right, like this blob right here. And this has a particular structure associated with it. So this is what we call the tertiary structure of a protein. But in order for this protein to take this particular shape, what does it have to have right in here? It's got to have that alpha helix. And it can only have this alpha helix right here because of the proper primary structure. So tertiary structure is determined by the secondary structure, which is determined by the primary structure. So the tertiary structure is determined by the primary and secondary structure of a protein. And this tertiary structure of this particular molecule right here allows it to have a little cavity inside of it so that it can bind some other kind of molecule, like maybe a heme group that has an iron. So now this molecule can transport oxygen through our body. Right? So do you think that might be a good idea? Do we need oxygen? Absolutely. So this would be a good example of how we start to put hemoglobin together. Right? And guess what happens to the oxygen carrying capacity of our blood if all of a sudden we have a little mutation and we can't build this protein correctly? We substitute an amino acid maybe in this location of the alpha helix. We change the primary structure right here. What happens to the secondary structure? It changes, and now the tertiary structure changes, and now this molecule can't bind the heme group, and you can't carry oxygen in the blood. Okay, that's a disease process, maybe due to, right, just a change of a substitution of one amino acid in this group right here. Okay, so we don't want to change the tertiary structure. And when we change the tertiary structure of a protein, sometimes we call that denaturation. And denaturation can take place by heat or, for instance, pH. Let me talk a little bit about denaturation before we go. Okay. Let's see. Maybe you're going to have hamburger tonight for dinner. All right. So you got some raw hamburger. And unless we have some people from Europe, they like to eat raw hamburger. How do you like to eat hamburger? Cooked. Yeah, I prefer mine cooked, right? So I'll make a hamburger, put it on the barbecue. And just as I'm about ready to sit down and eat, I get a telephone call. And it's some friends of mine that say, hey, pool table just opened up. You got to come down and shoot some pool with us. Because we got three people, we need a fourth person. And what am I going to say? No, I just made a hamburger and I got to stay home? No, I probably wouldn't say that, right? So I say, okay, I'll be down there in just a second. So I take my cooked hamburger. Is there a difference between raw hamburger and cooked hamburger? Is it obvious? Absolutely. All right, same proteins, but they have been denatured. The shape has been changed in them. That preserves the food, changes the texture. So I take the cooked hamburger, which is hot, put it in the refrigerator, and now it's cold. Does it turn back into raw hamburger again? No, right? It just, the temperature changes. So once you denature a protein, we say that it is irreversibly changed. It's been denatured. The shape of that protein has been changed. It can't go back to its original shape. And when we've changed the shape of that protein, what else have we changed? When we change the shape, we change the function of that protein as well. Okay, so when we denature something, we can take a functional protein and turn it into a non-functional protein. But can we ever get the function back? Why can't we get the function back of a denatured protein? Because we can never get the same shape back. A protein, when it's made, automatically takes the right shape. But if we take a protein that's all made at once and just let go of it, it won't form the right shape. It actually has to form the right shape as it's being made inside the cell. Okay. So we're going to start with, okay, protein structure and look at see how proteins are stabilized next time. All right. So we'll do that on Thursday.